You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Heritage Radio Network, housed in the fabulous Roberta's Restaurant in Brooklyn. Thanks for joining me. I'm Michelle Nashan, and the name of the show is It's More Than Food. Genetically modified organisms, otherwise known as GMOs, what are they, and why is there such a huge disagreement about whether they should be in our food? After all, it's more than food, right? So according to recent estimates by the Center for Food Safety, 70% of all processed food contain GMOs, 85% of United States corn, 91% of soybeans, 95% of sugar beets, seems to be in almost everything. Now, from the side of science in some pretty respected organizations like the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, otherwise known as FAO, there are many solid arguments for the use of GMOs. FAO has listed a whole bunch, and they include increased agricultural productivity, such as better resistance to pests and extreme weather, like drought and famine-resistant rice, potential benefits for the environment, believe it or not, more food from less land, longer shelf lives on food, so less spoilage, and then potential benefits for human health. Genes responsible for producing the precursor or the setup vitamin A have been inserted into rice plants, vaccines, medicines, the list goes on. Now, on the flip side, while many claim that the science is not conclusive, GMOs have been linked to serious health concerns such as cancer, miscarriage, and organ damage. So this is a huge issue and obviously perfect for this show because, again, it's more than food. Now, joining me to talk about this heavy subject are the one and only Fred Kaufman, who is a renowned author, renowned journalist and author of You Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food, and Scott Faber, vice president at the Environmental Working Group, most recently known for his focused work on the Just Label It campaign, along with Gary Hirschberg from Stonyfield Farm. So listen, these guys are a big deal. They're uber engaged regarding this issue. I could go on and on about how incredibly qualified they are, but just check out their bios on heritageradionetwork.org. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
Great, Michelle. Great to be here. It's Fred.
Okay, awesome. And I think I heard Scott there as well. Scott, how are you, man?
I'm great.
Awesome. Cool. Oh, you're so welcome. So listen, good to hear both of your voices and to see you. Let's start with Scott. Scott, this Just Label It thing, this was what the Proposition 37 in California was all about. Tell us about the premise and the goals of the Just Label It campaign and about where we stand as the U.S. compared to other countries on GMO usage.
It's still astounding to me and to your listeners that 64 other countries, including beacons of liberty like Saudi Arabia and China, have given their consumers the right to know what's in their food, but the United States, the so-called land of liberty, has not. And that means that now more than half the world's consumers, more than 3 billion consumers, have the right to know whether there are genetically engineered ingredients in their food. And it's not because consumers in the U.S. don't want to know. I mean, poll after poll shows that more than 90% of Americans, regardless of age, income, gender, even party affiliation, want to know what's in their food. So I think what this is really one of those issues where the politicians haven't yet caught up with the consumers.
Well, that's interesting. So just to clarify, is this an anti-GMO campaign? Just labeling?
Not at all. You don't have to be anti-GMO to be pro-labeling. And in fact, many people who are pro-GMO who are continue to be optimistic that biotech will deliver on the promises that were made 20 years ago. Many people who are pro-GMO are also pro-labeling because they they believe, as I'm sure most of your listeners do, that people have a basic right to know what's in their food. They want to be able to make the right choices for their families, and they want to know for a whole bunch of different reasons. They may not have a lot of faith in the regulatory system for GMOs. They may be worried about all of the increases in herbicides that have accompanied GMOs. They may have religious objections to tinkering with food at the genetic level. There are lots of reasons that people want to know whether there's GE ingredients in their food, but what unites them is just the simple notion that people have a right to know. They don't want to know less about what's in their food. They want to know more.
Okay, now, just to clarify, because I heard you say GE ingredients, we're not talking about General Electric. what's the GE thing?
That's right, genetically engineered ingredients.
Got it. So genetically engineered, genetically modified, same thing. And I would guess that those that are for the science of GMO would really love to vote with their dollars. They're going to want to spend their dollars on this new technology, and they're going to want to see that products that have these ingredients do well. So in many ways, it's almost kind of like this egalitarian or almost a very democratic approach. It's like, well, label it and then let the consumer make their own choice,
yeah,
correct?
And you know, it's so obvious, but to you and our listeners, but we know a lot about what's in our food. We know how much salt, sugar, and fats in our food. We know whether our food has high fructose corn syrup. We know whether it has chemical food additives. We even know, because FDA requires that we know, whether our orange juice is made from concentrate. And so why would it make sense for the government to compel food manufacturers to tell us something, you know, arguably as trivial as whether orange juice is made from concentrate, and not compel the same companies to tell us something that we're really interested in knowing about? And so that's, I think, what's really, and I think what we've seen is that the good companies, the smart companies, companies like Ben & Jerry's and Whole Foods have figured this out, that if you trust consumers, if you trust them to make the right choices for the families, you give them more information, and those are the companies that are ultimately going to be successful.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, Scott, I have two children living with diabetes, so I remember, you know, jumping for joy and doing backwards somersaults when it became required for food manufacturers to label ingredients and, you know, what really is in food. And I remember that a lot of folks in the nutrition movement specifically really thought that this was actually going to lead to great gains in either reducing or slowing the onslaught of obesity and other stuff. And it just, to me, it just hasn't seemed to work. I mean, you know, I mean, maybe you could make the argument that today, I think 30% of Americans now are suffering from obesity. Maybe it would be 40% if there wasn't labeling, but the increase has been so incredible. It almost seems like you can really like write in black and white on the package, and some Americans just don't take heed. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, and you know, the label on our packages, the Nutrition Facts Panel, is sort of like the little engine that could. I mean, people put so much stock in the label, and certainly it's better than not to let consumers make the choice when they go to the supermarket, and certainly hopefully we'll soon be able to make the choice when they go to a restaurant. But there are so many things that have changed in our culture in the last 30 years that have contributed to rising levels of obesity. First and foremost is that we eat out so much more.
I own a restaurant.
Food dollar is consumed out of the home. You know, and of course our lifestyles have changed. We've become more sedentary, and we're eating at our desks. We're not eating with our family. So there, to simply point at the label and say it didn't work doesn't really capture all the other changes that are happening around us.
Yeah, interesting. Now, Fred, from reading some of your articles on GMOs, it sounds like your biggest concern isn't about so much the potential environmental or health effects, but that the idea that companies are patenting seeds, selling them for huge profits, it's not about protecting things like the ability to innovate and stuff. You have a really interesting take on this, and I'd love you to take us there if you wouldn't mind.
Well, thank you, Michelle. Scott makes some great points here, And I think also what you're alluding to is undeniable, which is that we always can't forget in these conversations that the number one ecological hit on the earth every year is agriculture. And so I'm certainly not in any way, shape, or form saying that we don't have concerns on every level, not only with GMO and pesticide use and the utility patents surrounding Monsanto's seeds, which necessitate a certain herbicide. I am not discounting any of that. However, I think that my main argument really has to do with, as you put it, where the money is and trying to follow the money. And I think I actually take, in many ways, a much more radical position than Scott does, because I think that labeling, and I'm all for labeling and I'm all for transparency, but I don't believe that is going to be the most efficient way to achieve what I think are the more important aims. Well, I should say the most important aim of the food movement, to my mind, which is getting the huge transnational players, people like Monsanto and Dow and Syngenta, trying to make a dent into their ownership of the world's food source. And so labeling, I think, is great. It's great for the consumer, but I think ultimately it's not really going to hurt the worst players in global food. And because it's ultimately, I don't believe, it's not going to be a direct hit on their profit streams. Now, how do we then achieve those aims? How do we get the money out of Monsanto, and how do we stop these large transnationals? I think there are a couple of ways. We have to remember why they're in it in the first place. They're in it for the money, and the money comes from rent, and the rent comes from their intellectual property, and their intellectual property comes from their patents. Since 1930, there's been a Plant Patent Act in the United States, and new creations in plants allow the owners to earn rent. And ever since some Supreme Court decisions in the 1970s and 1980s, new life forms, and particularly new plant life forms, have also been patentable. And so the fact of the matter is that you now have very large companies like Monsanto and Dow and Syngenta and Bayer AgroScience, and they are in the business of patenting as much food as possible, owning it, earning rent on it, and suing other people who get in their way. So really the best way to stop them is to reform those patent laws and to say, you cannot have a 20-year patent. Maybe you can't even have a 2-year patent. Maybe we shouldn't even be able to own life forms as they pertain to food. What a radical idea. You know, we've had agriculture for 10,000 years. Nobody has ever actually owned any of the proprietary technology such as seeds up until very recently. And on many levels, this is a total outrage. I am doing an article right now. My next article actually is trying to get a little bit of a guide from the open source software movement. I mean, really, when we're talking about GMOs and we're talking about DNA, really we're talking about these huge, monstrous sequences of proteins that are really only available to be used through bioinformatics or huge computer programs with huge data storage facilities.
Okay, hang on a second. So translate bioinformatics.
Well, bioinformatics
is really the way
GMOs come to be. What is DNA? DNA are these immensely long sequences of proteins, and the only way that these scientists work and transform them and work with them and clip them and put them together so that they can patent them are through computer programs. So biology and agriculture and computer science are all converging now, Michelle, and they're going to converge even more in the future in terms of how research is done, in terms of how food is transformed and altered and genetically manipulated. And so really I was looking at this kind of nexus of computer science and biological science, and all of a sudden it occurred to me, really the great movement we've seen in software is the open source movement. Well, why not open source GMO? What better way to knock down Monsanto right at the knees than to say, hey, instead of having proprietary DNA sequences, how about open source DNA sequences? That will move them out of the business, Michelle.
You know, that it's interesting, you know, you and I, Fred, had a conversation a while back that really led me to, inspired me to actually take this up as a subject on the show here. And that was, you compared it kind of to the restaurant industry. Obviously strikes my heart. I'm a chef. I have a restaurant. I have a family. I have five kids. I feed. It's about food. My livelihood and my career has been based on that. And it's interesting because the restaurant industry is one of the largest employers in the world. In the world, no question about it. We employ more people, feed more people, and the success of our industry has been based on the fact that nothing is patentable. I mean, what I would envision is that if we use the argument that for us to actually make it worth our while as an industry to innovate, that we need to be able to patent stuff. There might only be three or four categories of restaurants, right? I mean, but
yeah, what we're looking at here when we're looking at the restaurant business and we're looking at the whole business of food is we're looking at the creative commons. We're looking at a lot of people working together for a common goal of better food, and really, cooking is open source. I mean, you clearly cannot, you know, copy somebody's page from their cookbook and put it in Michel Nichon's cookbook. We understand that kind of intellectual property.
That does happen.
However, we are seeing tremendous intellectual production without intellectual property in the restaurant business and in the proliferation, the creative proliferation of recipes. Now, the one criticism, and I'll just bring it up, because I was out yesterday, I was having a long conversation about this same topic, and the criticism was, well, Fred, if you argue for open source and if you argue for lessening of patent rights, won't that lead to the proliferation of genetically modified organisms? And my response was, hey, listen to the statistics Michelle just read at the beginning of the show. Yeah. We already have a proliferation of genetically modified organisms. We have this tremendous proliferation. So the question is, which way is it going to go? How is this technology going to be utilized going forward? Because sadly, it's not going away. And maybe it's conceivable there are some good reasons to have this technology. I spent about a year doing research for my book, going from one genetic modification laboratory to another across the United States. And I saw literally hundreds, I mean, not just soy and corn, but I saw hundreds of melons and tobacco and grapes and all of these very widely variegated products that are being genetically modified. Wheat is, the genome has just been completed, and that's really next in line. And I talked to the scientists, and these guys, as you point out at the beginning, they actually should be the allies of food justice people in this fight. They are our natural allies, actually, for labeling, because they're interested in getting away from this, what they call a patent thicket. They can't move to the right or the left in terms of their creative research without having to pay somebody off, having to pay another person off. If there were not so many patents, if there was a creative commons, maybe they could start work on something that actually could make a difference in global food justice and would not simply go straight into the pockets of the transnationals.
Yeah, like drought-resistant rice and all that good stuff. Now, what's interesting is, you know, as a restaurateur and as a realist, because I do a lot of study and all that good jazz, and I do know that we have some real challenges with climate change in India. The monsoon patterns have changed. They're getting less harvests of rice. So technology definitely plays a role. But also, as a restaurateur, one of the things that's been really remarkably, amazingly successful for me has been, you know, putting and celebrating the producers that we buy our food from on the menu and really telling the story and stuff. And I think, Scott, what you're looking at here in the labeling argument perhaps is a way to see some of these stories emerge about these scientists, because you read about it, you know, guys that have come up with this brilliant drought resistant rice or beta carotene in rice, and you know, some of these things that actually could be real game changers in an area of the world where there is no more water. GMOs actually can expose some of those stories, or labeling would actually allow an opportunity for people to actually tie to some of these stories. Are you looking at it as that type of an informational floodgate that you can open up through labeling, or is it really just about the labeling? What's on your mind?
No, I think you've hit the nail right on the head, which is that that we're in an age where consumers have more information at their fingertips, and so we're not simply talking about what you can learn from the label, although that's certainly part of it. They have more information at their fingertips, and they also want to know more. They want to not just know what's in their food, but where their food came from, who made their food. They want that story because more and more consumers are using that information to make choices and ultimately help address make sure that what they're buying is consistent with their values. So I think, you know, to your point and Fred's point, if consumers choose to buy crops that help promote technological advances, that help feed more people or address the problems associated with drought and climate change, that they should be able to do that. I think what we've seen so far, and I'm sure Fred's found this as he's been researching his book, that conventional breeding has produced as many breakthroughs as genetic modifications and
more.
More breakthroughs as opposed to the promise of GE modifications, and that what we've also found that is that the argument for protecting the so-called intellectual property hasn't really been borne out, that we haven't seen the sort of innovations that the lawyers would expect, or at least argue that we would see in GE crops. We haven't, and in fact, what we've instead seen is less and less choice for farmers because the big seed companies have bought up more of the smaller seed companies, so it's been harder for farmers to find the conventional seeds, and the per acre cost of those seeds has grown by more than 300% since 1995, when we really started to see GE crops introduced into commerce. So I think, but to your original point, you know, consumers really want and expect to know more, and the companies that get that are going to be successful, and politicians are really beginning to catch up as well. We've seen now 26 states introduce either legislation to require GE labeling or to put GE labeling issues on the ballot. Next week, Senator Barbara Boxer and other senators will introduce GE legislation here in Washington to try to push the Obama administration and FDA to require GE labeling, as the president promised to do when he was running in 2007. So I think what we're seeing more and more is that not only are good companies like Ben & Jerry's and Whole Foods and others kind of catching up with their customers, we're starting to see political leaders catch up with voters by introducing legislation and pushing the administration to simply give consumers in 64 countries give us what consumers in 64 countries already have.
You know, it's amazing to me because I think, you know, I am a retailer in a way. You know, as a restaurateur, I buy food wholesale, I turn it into something, and then I sell it at a retail price to my customer. And perhaps it's just the nature of the business because I go out into the dining room, I talk to my customers, they call me on the phone, they email me, they text me, they tweet me. And not a day goes by where somebody doesn't say, "So what's in this? Where's it from? Wow, this is awesome. Tell me about this." Or we'll ask the server before they even order, they'll say, "Is this farm-raised?" I just had this last night. "So is this farm-raised salmon? Is it Alaskan farm-raised?" People even know now that there's wild Alaskan salmon and that there's aquaculture in Alaska, and they're asking before they make the order. So I can't imagine that pressure isn't there. And I'm thinking, though, you know, maybe the point here is that this is a small step in that kind of consumer awareness that really kind of opens the dialogue. And it's interesting. It's almost like the journey with legalizing marijuana in some states, legalizing, you know, civil unions or gay marriage, the right to, you know, that whole argument, you know, started with propositions that seemed outlandishly crazy that got defeated, but then they just kept coming back. And the more reasonable Americans actually got their arms around the rights around these issues, that they actually got their traction. You know, but it's interesting to me because I can't help but get back to how convenience-based the American public is, and that the labeling gets us to a certain point, but this intellectual property thing seems to have legs. And I'm going to want to talk about that when we get back on break. But what are you guys thinking about this? I mean, Fred, small steps, are they good enough? What do you think?
I think the argument that I hear again and again is that this is a first step, that labeling is the first step towards moving, you know, towards a greater movement against GMOs. That's what I hear from a lot of the activists. I have to say, Michelle, I am not so sure. I am a little bit skeptical, and that is the one way that I am skeptical about labeling, in the sense that I feel that if this stuff goes through, if it becomes all about the consumer, then these large companies are going to be very reactive to the consumers, and they're going to make this concession, and we're going to see the labeling. And I think ultimately there's a danger, which is that that label is going to be preaching to the choir, the people who are already looking at the labels, the people who are already using their smartphones to see the provenance of their food are now going to, you know, be able to know more perhaps. But those are people that are already aware and are not purchasing a lot of the processed foods. And then I think when we go back and we say, okay, we haven't made a dent into the business model of Monsanto, how then can we stop a true evil from propagating, right? How can we stop it? I think we're going to hear from the lobbyists and from the corporate people, look, we have just given you the biggest concession of any food company ever. You know, there is no other there is no other label for anything like this that we've just given you for GMO. So now get off our backs.
Oh.
And I'm afraid that's the kind of logic that might conceivably be the backlash from labeling. I'm just trying to look around the corner, and I'm just thinking, you know what? There are dangers here, because this is not simply about a consumer's right to know. This is about the largest profit streams in international food.
So it is.
And the whole notion of who is going to own rights to the world's food going forward. And that's what's happening with genetic modification and patented food.
So you've made it now about good and evil. So I feel like I need to get somebody from the religious movement in here. No, seriously.
Scott, see, I think that we should not be afraid of using even if we're secular, of using terms like this, Michelle. I use them in full awareness, because what we're talking about is food. What we're talking about is the most essential thing to human life on the planet. I venture to say food is more important than sex to human life on the planet.
Fred, my wife is going to have an issue with that
and
statement.
Every time you had to have sex, you had to pay a little fee. I'm sure people would be up in arms about that. That would be true evil.
Hey, dude,
same thing is happening in food.
Sometimes I have to empty the dishwasher.
It actually very slowly will be part of proprietary ownership.
Yeah.
This is a big problem. We have to figure out. The legal system is in no way, shape, or form ready to deal with the technologies we have. We have this old patent law, and all of a sudden we're allowing people to change genomes here and there, and then own entire genomes for soybean and for the hugest crops on earth. This is an outrage, and we've got to figure out a way to stop it.
Yeah. So, Scott, I mean, your thoughts on this thing before we start to close for break?
Sure. Well, I think Fred's made some great points. I mean, labeling is a step. I'm not sure it's the first step. There are lots of reforms that are needed in our food system. One is certainly labeling. Consumers want to know what's in their food. The other is looking at the whole regulatory system that we use to approve or to give consent to the use of GE ingredients in commerce. That hasn't been updated in more than 20 years. It predates the introduction of GE crops into commerce. And there are lots of opportunities right now for Congress to intervene. I mentioned Senator Boxer and Congressman DeFazio have a labeling bill. We expect other legislation to modernize the system that we use to review whether or not GE crops, whether these novel foods are ultimately safe or have environmental effects that we've not really carefully considered. There will be passing a farm bill later this year that provides lots of opportunities for farmers to transition to other kinds of cropping systems. So there's many places where consumers, voters, activists can get involved in shaping our food system.
Yeah. Wow, awesome. You guys are freaking fabulous. Now, listen, we're going to take a break. I do want to mention Wholesome Wave is a sponsor of today's show, so I want to highlight that their fourth annual conference is coming up in Washington, D.C., focused on helping consumers struggling with poverty, along with small and mid-sized local farmers become heroes for a healthier America. I'm here with my sidekick, Ralph. He's been very quiet. We haven't invited him in yet, but maybe in the second part of the show, Ralph Leglisi and I are going to have a beer because we're at Roberta's in Heritage Radio Network here in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and Fred and Scott are going to wish they were here having a beer with us. Heritage Radio Network, the ever vibrant Roberta's restaurant. We'll be back in just a few minutes with It's More Than Food.
And you're listening to IDID by a man that goes by Obesity on heritageradionetwork.org. HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a member-supported nonprofit organization. If you like what you're listening to, go to our website and click that donate button. Become a member and get special discounts, invites, VIP treatment, t-shirts, and more. Support us in our mission to bring you the freshest food content in the nation. And this one's called Andy's Burnt Biscuits by our friend Pamela Royale on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the Heritage Radio Network, housed in Roberta's Restaurant in Brooklyn. I'm Michelle Nashan, and if you were with us earlier, you already know it's more than food, much more than food. And I'm not just talking about the show. We're talking about genetically modified organisms and what's the best approach to really kind of bring this potential monster under some kind of a reasonable control. Now, it's interesting because I've spent a lot of time out and abroad and have spoken with, you know, some biophysicists and biochemists and folks that really do believe that if we don't take some kind of an approach through science, that the explosion of the world population, the incredible pressures that climate change is creating, that the traditional manipulation of crops through hybridization and other techniques known to man for, you know, millennia just aren't going to be enough to get us out of this mess. Joining me today are Fred Kaufman, renowned journalist, author of Bet the Farm, How Food Has Stopped Being Food, and Scott Faber, vice president of the Environmental Working Group, most recently known for his focused work on the Just Label It campaign. Gentlemen, welcome back.
Thank you, Michelle.
Yeah. And so Scott, you know, on the labeling issue, I mean, how close do you think you guys are to seeing this? You said 26 states now are moving this legislation forward. You have folks on there. You guys really are working with a lot of allies on this. And any indications of where you think the labeling might strike first and have some success?
Well, you know, without a doubt, Washington State is the state to watch. It'll be on their ballot in the fall. And Washington State is fascinating because for three reasons. One is salmon. The salmon industry is united behind the requirement for labeling because FDA will soon approve for a sale in the marketplace a GE salmon that grows twice as fast as an ordinary salmon. The second reason, and Fred alluded to this earlier, is wheat. We may soon see more and more genetically engineered wheat, and almost all of the wheat grown in Washington State is for export to Pacific Rim countries that require segregation and labeling of GE crops. And the third is apples, and we haven't touched on this yet, but there will soon be for sale in commerce a GE apple that is designed to essentially not to brown when you cut it. And Washington is a huge apple industry that is also very concerned about consumer confusion and the risk of drift associated with GE apples. And so unlike California, where agriculture was more or less opposed to Prop 37, the labeling initiative that was on the ballot in California, in Washington, we'll see just the opposite, where the salmon industry, where many apple and wheat farmers will be fighting hard for GE labeling because it's in their economic future depends on it. So Washington State will be one of the fascinating states to watch this year. And then there are a number of other states, especially in the Northeast, where the legislatures will be taking up GE labeling and where governors, state political leaders have come out strongly in favor of GE labeling. But I do think that all of this activity, the fact that 26 states are now taking this issue up in one way or another, is forcing companies, food companies, to reevaluate whether the fight is actually worse for them than the label. That is, you know, whether the cost to their brand reputation, the cost of looking like they have something to hide, the cost of engaging in what are frankly pretty deceptive acts to persuade voters and policymakers to oppose labeling, whether those costs are ultimately greater to them from a bottom-line perspective than simply putting a may-contain statement or a may-contain genetically engineered statement on the back of a package. And so a lot of good companies, smart companies, are either dropping out of the fight against GE labeling or actually switching sides to say, look, you know what, I trust my consumers. I don't want to appear to have something to hide. I'm going to support putting labeling on my package, even if I'm not making the transition to a GE-free product.
Well, it's interesting because I think of retailers as an interesting tool in this argument. You said that Whole Foods, for instance, has you know moved into this arena. They are a big consumer of the wholesale industry. Any idea where Walmart stands on this? My thought would be this could give them a competitive public relations advantage in saying, listen, we see this as important to our consumers. We're going to start requiring it's almost like a back pressure, right? We're going to require anybody that we buy food from to provide this labeling, or we might do it ourselves. And any indication on which way they lean?
You know, I don't know, but I can say that big retailers and have through their associations and through other ways have said we don't want to get in a sense in the middle of this fight. We don't want to get on the wrong side of this with our customers. So while big so far Walmart, Costco, Target, others haven't come out against or for GE labeling. They've basically said, look, if this is what our customers want, we're going to give it to them, and we're going to put pressure on manufacturers to give our customers what they want. And, you know, that's obviously a time-tested formula for success. I think what we have seen, one change we have seen is that more and more companies are coming forward to say, look, many of the arguments that were made in California, especially around the cost of labeling to consumers, really don't hold water, and you don't hear those arguments being made so much in California. The advocates against labeling were saying, well, this was going to increase the price of food by $400 a year for an average family. Just ridiculous arguments. And I think companies have realized that no one believes that. Even ordinary consumers know from experience that companies are changing labels all the time. There have now been studies that have come out that have documented what you know from experience, that changing the label to include the words genetically engineered is a trivial cost that won't affect the price of food at retail. So I think one thing we have seen is that some of the tactics used by big companies have changed. And again, we started to see some of the big companies say, we don't want to be associated with this campaign. At heart, we want to be an industry that gives consumers more information, not less information. And this fight against labeling has really been sort of an aberration. In the last few years, with some prodding, especially by First Lady Michelle Obama, industry has been giving consumers more and more information. They've been giving them more information on the front of packages about calories, sugar, fat, and sodium. They're giving them more information, in part because of initially a lot of state activity, about calories on menu boards. So the trend of the last decade or so has been to give consumers more information, not less information, and companies, manufacturers, retailers have seen that trend, have been responding.
Yeah, it's interesting, and they should try to do it in 140 characters or less if we want to follow the, you know what I'm saying? Now, Fred, on this open sourcing thing, you know, I'm a fan of the idea, no question, because I especially love that you had tied it to the success of the restaurant industry. You know, but here's my question. You know, because frankly, yeah, a lot of people know me as a good food advocate and all that good jazz, and I am. There's no question. I believe you are what you eat, but I also do believe in science, and I do believe in the notion of applying technology to figure out the best and safest way forward and all that good jazz. And I'm also aware, much thanks to some of the knowledge that you've shared with me, really aware that there are some scientists out there that really are working hard to solve some of these climate-related issues, et cetera, and that they're being turned back because, you know, their products just aren't viewed as viable because they don't require some kind of egregious, herbicide chemical to thrive or whatever. It's not linked to another patent. But if we open sourced it, and that disincentivized some of these multinational corporations because they would never, no longer have this huge, almost monopolistic market advantage, would that also stifle these scientists from coming up with the drought-resistant rice, the beta-carotene, all of that? What does that mean for
Michelle,
these scientists? Where are they going to get their money from?
Scientists are being stifled by the patent thicket right now. Scientists who are interested in molecular transformation of plants are having a difficult go at it because every step of the way they have to, in terms of their technology, they have to pay off money to other people who own other patents on all of the techniques that they're using.
Fred,
the intellectual property regime now in place is stifling the creativity. Let me go back for a second, though, and make a point about Walmart, which I think is a very, very interesting element of this puzzle to focus on. If Walmart is in the balance here, along with the other largest retailers, if they are agnostic, if they are sitting here thinking, okay, which way the wind blows, and if our consumers want that label, we're going to give it to them, right? What does that tell you? What does that tell you about the effect that GMO labeling will have on the largest transnational producers of food? If Walmart's okay with it, I'll tell you one thing, I'm not okay with it. That's something that is very indicative of the fact that the labeling actually is not going to do very much, I don't believe, to the status quo in terms of how food is made and where that money is flowing. And that is what really bothers me the most, because a lot of people, I think, have the perception, and I'm not sure that Scott is or is not among them, but the perception that labeling is going to be the answer to the problem being proprietary money flowing to the largest food companies in the world going forward, as long as this patent regime and this intellectual property regime is in place.
All right, so let's bring Scott in.
Labeling doesn't affect it, and so labeling simply is going to make, and I'm sorry, labeling might make an affluent American consumer change her buying habits in the grocery store, but it's really not going to do anything to the real problems we have in global food.
So, Scott, let's bring you in. Let's respond to that. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I think Fred's raised some really good points. I mean, clearly, this notion of patenting food and treating food the same way we treat software is troubling, and that's something that we need to look at. We certainly need to look at our patent laws to see whether or not they make sense in this greater context of food. What's always been mind-boggling to me, and I'm sure Fred's discovered this as well, is that different parts of the government are really treating this whole issue differently. So on the one hand, you have the patent office saying these are novel technologies, novel foods that deserve patent protection because that's obviously the outcome that their creators want. On the other hand, that's the left hand of the government. On the right hand, you have FDA saying, you know what, these are the corn that makes its own insecticide, that's just like regular corn. Salmon that grows twice as fast as ordinary salmon, that's just regular salmon. And that's the argument that FDA is using to argue that, you know, these are substantially equivalent foods that that consumers don't have the right to know whether or not they've been created through genetic modifications or not. So,
in fact, Scott, if I can just, I'll even one up you there about the FDA, which is that they're not actually even making the call. You're giving them more credit than they deserve. What they're actually asking for is for the companies that are creating these products to self-certify. They're saying, you're certifying that this is substantially equivalent, so, you know, mark that checkbox, and that's what happens. Now, I don't even think the point is necessarily safe or not. Obviously, a public health risk is a problem. But I think that, and I'm not sure, however, that labeling is going to necessarily even stop the public health risk that is perceived by a lot of people. In other words, if a lot of people are perceiving that there's a huge public health risk in the genetic alterations in soy or in corn, how is the label itself going to stop people who are already eating it from eating it? They're going to be eating it, you know, so that doesn't stop it.
Fred's made, you know, the points Fred's make is true not just for genetically engineered ingredients, and again, I think the key point here is these aren't even really reviews. They're notifications that industry has conducted some proprietary science that FDA, you know, can't really even review, some of which is CBI. But that problem applies not just
CBI?
To GE ingredients. It applies to food additives. It applies to ingredients in other consumer products. I mean, this is, and I think his bigger point's right on the mark, which is that simply requiring labeling is not going to solve some of these bigger problems about that are really symptomatic of a bigger breakdown with our regulatory system, but it is a step, and it's a step that some consumers, certainly not most consumers, but that some consumers will use in order to make the right choices for their families or for themselves. And so while it's certainly not going to solve all of the problems that we face in our food system, it's not going to provide the guarantee of safety that consumers deserve and demand.
Right. So
giving consumers the tool is certainly a step that will help some consumers make better choices.
Yeah, great point. Now, walking back, in the sake of defining acronyms, you mentioned CVI. Could you explain that for our listeners?
I'm sorry. So, you know, we can certainly go further down the rabbit hole, but I think the key point here is
rabbits are delicious.
Fred,
just
feel free
saying.
To jump in. That is that, you know, the way people probably presume And I think ordinary consumers presume that these genetically engineered ingredients are subject to government testing, government studies, and when in fact, what we have is a notification system where that allows companies to simply notify FDA that they've done industry-funded analysis that's concluded that these ingredients are substantially equivalent to the things we've been eating for hundreds or thousands of years, and therefore no additional analysis is needed. And much of that industry-funded science is treated as confidential business information or trade
CBI.
Secret information
that
consumers will never have access to.
Well, that's nutty.
I just want to make the point how, you know, it sounds nutty, but we have to, once again, let's look realistically and objectively at the big picture. People are making hybrid crops all the time, hybrid apples, hybrid carrots.
Yeah, understood.
Right? And when you make a hybrid, sometimes you get a failure. Your carrot is not a carrot. It doesn't work well. However, other times you get a viable crop. What's happening is the exact same thing with genetically modified crops, which is that they try 1,000 times or 10,000 times to get a viable grow out. And when they do, when they get a carrot or when they get an apple, that's the proof that they have that this is substantially equivalent. So really the argument that Scott is making, while I agree with him in spirit, is really the same for the entire food system all up and down the line, and that those foods that we're eating all the time are not exactly as what we think they are. They are constantly being created anew, they are constantly being modified, and they are constantly being part of proprietary ownership regimes.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think when we look at evolution within the natural system, and I'm a gardener. I have a quarter acre organic garden in my backyard. I've been managing it with my beautiful wife, Lori, for 12 years now. And we have watched our mustard go from really being able to give us a decent, you know, 5 to 6 month season to where now winter's over because we collected seeds and replanted the seeds. We did seed saving. And it seems like these plants have really grown to love our garden. So the argument is that when you look at the way corn assimilated, it's originally from Amazonia and through native trade made it all the way up to Nova Scotia. So, and some of that was through the hand of man and the cultivars, you know, the cultivators of these crops, but some of it was just the plant naturally assimilating to climate change. So that's obviously a natural part of the order, but one would assume, because I heard a story of tomatoes that were being injected with salmon genes so that they could last longer without refrigeration. Now, how can you argue that a tomato with a salmon gene in it is the same as any old other tomato? I don't see a salmon swimming into a tomato field and cross-populating.
And this was the argument I was making just the other night at NYU, which is that when I was doing a lot of work about 5 years ago with modified oysters, of all things, I learned from the scientists that DNA actually works in a very different way than we think it does. And that, in fact, I, Fred Kaufman, and you, Michel Nishan, that we actually share about a third of our genome with the oyster anyway. We have, DNA is a mess in our body. It's not like you've got this perfect circle and I've got this perfect square. All sorts of genetic material from all sorts of plants and animals are in us and in all sorts of other plants and animals. So in fact, yeah, it's really weird and disturbing when we see a glow-in-the-dark dog, because that dog has some genes from bioluminescence. It's really strange, and that's really something that probably is not going to happen in nature, okay? And that's something that has been done in the laboratory. By the same token, we have all sorts of DNA from all sorts of species mixed up within ourselves. That is not an argument neither for nor against genetic modification. That's simply a clarification of how DNA actually does work.
Interesting. So now, Scott, we're getting close to the close of the show. I dig the work that you've been doing. I really appreciate it because I do believe that we all have the right to know everything about anything that we want to buy. It is a basic American right, right? Our ability to be able to choose, you know, the foods that we want really is based on our right to the information so that we do know what we are consuming and whether it's legally considered a rapidly growing salmon considered the same or not. If a consumer does know, then they do have that opportunity to make a choice. And I would guess that, and I see this a lot in some of the work that we do, you know, through Wholesome Wave, where we work in underserved communities and provide, you know, affordable access for fruits and vegetables. What I am seeing is that when people living with poverty, and there are a lot of assumptions about people living with poverty that they either lack the education or the concern or about food, which is why they make such unhealthful food choices. And we found that by introducing affordability, there are, yes, some consumers in that population who still don't care about food, just like there are in middle America, and frankly, just like there are in affluent America. There are affluent kids who really couldn't care less about, you know, putting a bunch of junk food in their body. But we also have seen in these consumer bases that are thought to be disconnected from issues like this, that they actually do value buying from local farmers, producers, and sort in supporting local businesses, that they do want to feed their families healthier food. So I'm going to guess that there are some communities and community members outside of affluent communities that would benefit from this labeling. What are you guys' plans? I mean, if you guys are successful with the GMO labeling thing, is there a next step for you guys in this argument? I mean, do you see validity in moving towards what Fred's talking about in this intellectual property argument, or is it kind of like job done? We got the labeling. You know, let's move on to another subject. What's your thought?
Well, let me just start by saying I think that all the polling that's been done, all the work that's been done, has shown that consumers, regardless of income, want to know whether or not there are genetically engineered ingredients in their food. And just as you found through Wholesome Wave, that there are consumers, regardless of income, who want to incorporate more fruits and vegetables into their diet, but in some cases can't afford to or don't have access to those. So I don't think this is, I know there are people who are listening who'll say, well, you know, this is just people of a certain income level who care. That's all of consumer attitudes work has shown that that's not the case, that the desire to know what's in their food, in particular, the desire to know whether or not there are genetically engineered ingredients in our food, cuts across all demographics, age, income, race, gender, even a party affiliation. And so, and in fact, what's been fascinating about this issue is that there are more than 600 organizations that are members of the Just Label It campaign, and people can certainly join or add their organization to our campaign. And it spans the whole spectrum of from groups that are there because they have religious concerns, health issues, consumer issues.
Yeah.
We even have Tea Party groups that are members of Just Label It. And
yeah.
But what's fascinating about it is that the only thing that unites all of these groups is this notion that consumers have a right to know. I do think that there is but once we've won labeling, and I do think we'll see the win, we'll see the administration, once states have acted, taking a step to create a national scheme that requires labeling. Once we've won that fight, I think there's still a big constituency for ensuring that the way that we review GE ingredients, food additives, other things that we put in our food to make it last longer, taste better, look better, that there's a big constituency out there for ensuring that regulatory system provides a guarantee of safety, that we've for too many years have assumed incorrectly that the government is reviewing all of these ingredients that we put in our food to make sure that they're safe, and when in fact that's not been the case, that we've relied on industry funded science, on industry reviews that oftentimes our regulators, the FDA, never even see. And of course, there are many other fronts in the fight to ensure that we have a safer, more just food system. But certainly, that will be one of.
Well, we're going to have to end there real quick. Fred, 15 seconds. Plug your book.
Thank you, Michelle. Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food. It's I'm trying to add the financialization of the global food regime to the topics of food justice.
Cool.
And I think you enjoyed it, and I think it's a good story. And Scott, I think you're the first guy I need to sell a copy to.
Can't wait to read it.
Yeah, listen, I wish we had another hour. This is just such a fascinating subject. You guys have been terrific. For you listeners out there, thank you for listening to the Heritage Radio Network, housed in the infamous Roberta's Restaurant in Brooklyn. I'm Michelle Nashan. As you may have found today, it's certainly more than food. And we'll be back next month, May 16th, Mother's Month. Join us on It's More Than Food. Go out and treat your loved one to a fabulous meal tonight. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.